Sorry for my 3-week delay in posting. I had been busy for the last few weeks dealing with some stuff. Now, there are some stories to get to today. One of them is the Social Security increase, and that's going to see its big, it's going to see its highest increase in 40 years. But will this increase be enough? I'm going to assume it's not, because they don't calculate this shit right anyway. The consumer prices had soared in June and July at an annual rate of 5.4%. Which is the highest that it's been since 2008. Steeper prices for gas, food, cars, and countless other things are squeezing Americans, especially the older ones with fixed and modest incomes. But there's a bright side. The spike in inflation could provide seniors next year with their biggest Social Security boost in almost 4 decades. In fact, advocates just raised their prediction for how large the 2022 cost of living adjustment, also known as the COLA, is likely to be. So, like I said, they don't do this right because there's 12 months in a year, and they only calculate the COLA by 4 months out of the year when they should calculate all 12. This is why the COLA doesn't raise like it should be. Meanwhile, the members of Congress have proposed proposed changes in the way the COLA is calculated, which could result in an even bigger benefit checks for the 55 million retirees, their dependents, and survivors. Seniors are now scrambling to find ways to save money as inflation takes its toll, but will the next Social Security increase be enough for them? Based on how inflation ran in 2020, Social Security's cost of living adjustments for this year, which began affecting payments in January, was only a 1.3% boost, and that ain't good enough. It boosted benefit checks by about $20, according to an estimate from the advocacy group, the Senior Citizens League. This year's price hikes have gobbled up that increase. Following the release of the government's July inflation data on Wednesday, the League projected that Social Security benefits could be boosted in 2022 by 6.2%, which was up from the group's previous forecast of a 6.1% COLA for next year. If the advocates are right, Social Security's checks would see their biggest increase since 1983, when the seniors back in 1983 saw a 7.4% increase in their COLA. The Social Security Administration will announce the 2022 COLA within the next couple weeks. A generous increase could be bittersweet. Mary Johnson, the Social Security and Medicare policy analyst at the Senior Citizens League, says that she says that some Social Security recipients could see cuts in other benefits because of their larger portion checks. The higher income could lead to trims in food stamps, rental assistance, or the Medicare extra help. Which covers most of the prescription drug costs, as Johnson tells MoneyWise. But advocates have been arguing for years that Social Security's COLAs shortchange seniors because they don't accurately reflect the prices that the older people pay. The legislation that would alter the way the raises are calculated has been introduced in the U.S. and the U.S. House of Representatives. The Fair COLA for Seniors Act of 2021 would base the annual adjustment on a consumer price index for the elderly. It would reflect the cost of items that typically purchased by people ages 62 and up, and it could result in the higher Social Security payments. Using a COLA that actually reflects how retirees spend their money, especially in healthcare, is a fucking no-brainer, but it would increase benefits and make the Social Security work better for the people it fucking serves, said the California Democratic Congressman John Garamendi, the bill's sponsor, said in a news release. Research by the Senior Citizens League shows that focusing on the prices actually paid by the elderly would have led to a larger COLA every year since 2016 if they had calculated it right. Retirees say that COVID has increased their financial pressure. In a new survey from the Senior Citizens League, over a third of the seniors, 34%, say they've used up their 401k or emergency savings since March of 2020. About one in five, which is 19%, report drawing down their retirement savings more than usual. The same percentage say that they have visited a food pantry or applied for food stamps since the pandemic began. The Senior Citizens League is calling on the Social Security Administration to take 3 big steps to better meet the increasing financial challenges that have been faced by the elderly. One of them is provide a one-time modest boost to all retirees to help increase the buying power of those Social Security benefits. 2, tie the annual inflation adjustment to a consumer price index that more accurately reflects the buying patterns of retired and disabled households, which tend to devote a bigger portion of their income to housing and medical expenses. The Fair COLA for Seniors Act would appear to do this if they calculated this right. Number 3, provide a guaranteed minimum COLA of no less than 3% every year. This would be especially important in years when there is deflation and the COLA drops below zero, as it has done 3 times in the past. The Federal Reserve has said repeatedly that it expects inflation to be transitory. But while prices are still fucking surging, there are several things all Americans, including seniors, can do to mitigate the budget-battering effects of inflation. If you're still making payments on your fucking mortgage, it's a good time to refinance and slash your monthly payment. 30-year mortgage rates are holding on below 3%, and the recent end of a pesky refinance fee has made the process an even better deal. To protect yourself from skyrocketing healthcare costs, look for a better deal on healthcare. Use a website that allows you to compare plans from hundreds of insurers to see if there's an option that provides the coverage you need, but with the lower premiums and out-of-pocket costs. When you shop online, take advantage of every bargain and don't overpay. Download a handy browser extension that hunts for lower prices instantly, provides the promo codes that the websites ask for during checkout. Investing can help ward off the effects of rising costs, but it's important to hedge your bets by diversifying, spreading your money around, and a popular app lets you invest in a diversified portfolio using little more than a spare change from everyday purchases. Now that's the end of that one. There's also a few other things I want to get to. Obviously, I've been watching Netflix for the last couple months. Obviously, my brother gave me his Netflix account, so I was watching The Walking Dead. They're getting ready to start season 11, but they only had season 1 through 10 on Netflix. So I was able to watch seasons 1 through 10 within just a little under 2 months. And that's because I was watching 5 to 6 episodes a day. And so now I'm watching this movie called The Irishman, which I have on pause. I've seen the movie Irishman before. It's a really good movie, so I'm watching it again. It's a mafia movie, based somewhat on the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, and Al Pacino did a good role for that one. I think sometime tomorrow, Wednesday and Thursday, because I work tomorrow 7 to 3, same thing with Wednesday, and then I'm off on Thursday from my other job. That we're going to try to get drive time in before winter hits. At least me and my mom are. We're talking about building up my drive time because I'm still going to need 50 hours and we're going to need to get this shit done. So hopefully I can get my hours in that I need. And then I spent a few days over at my brother's house, which was like Wednesday of last week, Thursday of last week, and Friday of last week. And this is the funniest thing because I work for Longhorn Steakhouse as my other job. And I'm able to get a discount at any of the Darden restaurants. And the guy that owns Longhorn Steakhouse owns about 7 other restaurants, and one of the restaurants he owns is Olive Garden along with Longhorn. Now, the funny thing is, when I went to go see my brother last week, Wednesday, we were debating about where to go to eat at when I got off of work. I said, because I'm constantly eating Longhorn Steakhouse, I said, eventually it's going to get tiring on you, and then you're going to want to try something else. And so I decided, okay, I've never been to Olive Garden, I said, so why not just go to Olive Garden and try to see if we can get in? And we were able to get in. It was the first time that I've ever been to Olive Garden in my 33 years of life. And of course, my brother and my mother did the same thing. When they ordered. They ordered the same plate, the Tour of Italy. And then I ordered an Alfredo plate. It had noodles and shrimp in it. I think it was seafood Alfredo is what I had. Something like that. Which was pretty good. We also had our soups and everything like that. And then we also had the bread as an appetizer. And then the day after, on Thursday, we went to Pepe's, which is a Mexican restaurant, and I've only been there twice. My brother and mother did their same meal, which is, they did the same thing as they did Wednesday. They ordered the same fucking meal, except for at a Mexican restaurant, you get burritos. And so they both ordered a burrito dinner, and I ordered a nacho platter. So, like, yeah, I love my nachos when it comes to them. I don't eat them all the time, but I do love my nachos when I go to a Mexican restaurant. Hold on a second here. We do have sad news in the world of music. Joey Ambrose has died. Even though he died like last week, but it was just randomly put up. And for people who don't know who Joey Ambrose is, he was a saxophonist for the band Bill Haley and the Comets. For anybody who might not know who Bill Haley and the Comets are, they were best known for their song Rock Around the Clock and Shake It, Rattle and Roll, which were their two most famous songs that they did back in, like, years ago. Here's another story to get to here. I was just noticing this. Even though it's from a couple days ago, it's already the 16th. This year, Social Security's birthday, August 14th, comes at an exciting moment. Congress is on the verge of greatly expanding our economic security through its upcoming reconciliation bill. Because Social Security cannot be addressed through budget reconciliation, it is not a part of that legislation, but given the overwhelming consensus among the American people in support of expanding Social Security's modest benefits, Congress should make it the next priority immediately after the Build Back Better legislation passes. Enacting legislation that expands the Social Security builds on the strong foundation laid down by President Franklin D. Roosevelt and his colleagues 86 years ago. On August 14th of 1935, and on that particular day, when President Roosevelt signed the Social Security into law, he described the new law as a cornerstone in a structure which is being built, but it is by no means complete. President Roosevelt was determined that Social Security would be a success, but in his January 17, 1935 message transmitting the proposed legislation to Congress, he cautioned, it is overwhelmingly important to avoid any danger of permanently discrediting the second and necessary policy of the federal legislation for economic security by attempting to apply it onto an ambitious of a scale before actual experience has provided guidance for the permanently safe direction of such efforts. In this place of such a fundamental in our future civilization is to process to be jeopardized now by extravagant action. Roosevelt's intention was to gradually expand the precious institution over time. Just 4 years after its passage, Congress expanded the Social Security to include the survivor and family benefits, and Congress continued to expand the Social Security for more than three decades. But then a billionaire-funded campaign seeking to discredit Social Security, and indeed government itself, stopped Congress from increasing benefits for the last 50 years or so. But now, at long last, a president who ran an expanding Social Security benefits sits in the Oval Office. Democrats control both chambers of Congress. Representative John Larson, who's a Democrat from Connecticut and leading champion of expanding Social Security, chairs the Social Security subcommittee of the House Ways and Means Committee. Senator Sherrod Brown, who's a Democrat from Ohio and a fighter for working families, chairs the Senate Finance Committee's Subcommittee on Social Security, Pensions, and Family Policy. A further expansion of Social Security is long overdue. This year, President Joe Biden and Congress had the opportunity to follow President Roosevelt's directive and take a large step forward. Expanding Social Security is both a wise policy and a smart policy. It is a solution to the nation's looming retirement income crisis when too many workers fear that they must work until they fucking die off. It is a solution to a moral, destabilizing income and basically a wealth inequality. It is a solution to squeeze on working families caught between the needs of the old and the young. The COVID pandemic, which is hitting seniors the hardest, has made the importance of Social Security even clearer. In the last year, many older workers lost their jobs or had to quit to stay safe. The pandemic has underscored the value of Social Security survivor disability and the old age benefits. After 50 years, many Social Security expansions are needed, and there should be an across the board benefit increase so that every current and future beneficiary gets a raise. Social Security's benefits are inadequately low by virtually any standard. In addition to the cross-the-board increase, Congress should enact the increases that are targeted to those populations that are most disadvantaged in the workplace and those aspects of the program most in need of updating, and these include updating Social Security's minimum benefit so that those who work a lifetime at low wages will not be retired into poverty. Come on. adopting a more accurate cost of living increase so that Social Security's modest benefits don't erode in value with each passing year, repealing the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset, which have prevented public servants from receiving their full Social Security benefits, providing credit towards future Social Security benefits. The 2021 RAND I don't know what the hell it was. Providing credit towards the future Social Security benefits to people, disproportionately women, who take time out of the paid workforce to care for children and other family members so as that many have had to do during the pandemic. Improving the benefits for those who are disproportionately poor, including widows and widowers, children living with grandparents, and the oldest beneficiaries. Ending the 5-month waiting period for Social Security disability beneficiaries, as well as the 24-month wait for them to receive Medicare. Updating the streamlining and expanding the companion supplemental security income program. All of these improvements are fully affordable. America is the wealthiest country in the history of the world, but they don't act like it. How we spend our money is a question of values. Do we use our commonwealth to give tax breaks to the rich, or do we use it to benefit all of us by expanding Social Security? I would go with the last part. Use it to expand Social Security. A robust expansion of Social Security benefits, funded by having millionaires and billionaires pay their fair share, is the best birthday present we could give the program and ourselves. By the time Social Security turns 87 next August, I am fucking confident that champions in Congress will introduce a robust bill to protect and expand the Social Security. Democrats should hold hearings and floor votes in the House and Senate. If Republicans try to block the legislation, Democrats should eliminate the filibuster and tell voters why they had to do it. Americans across the political spectrum support protecting and expanding Social Security, and they will reward the Democrats in 2022. And more importantly, we will be rewarding ourselves, our children, and their children. And that is true. Shit, hold on a second here. I'm all for expanding the Social Security. Also, there's been a lot of talks today about Biden pulling out the troops out of Afghanistan. That was long overdue. I agree with him on doing it. You can bitch about any Trump sycophant can bitch about all they want to about it, but Biden made the right decision in pulling the troops out. Let's see what else we got here. If you want to take a look at the tax hikes, basically looking for ways to help pay for his $1 trillion infrastructure plan, President Biden has aimed his sights at the oil and gas industry, among other proposals. The administration wants to raise the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%, and he wants to replace fossil fuel subsidies with clean energy incentives. The proponents estimate that eliminating these subsidies would yield more than $35 billion in tax recipients that could be funneled to renewable energy projects. In addition, congressional Democrats are drafting legislation that would tax big oil companies that release the most greenhouse gases between 2000 and 2019, claiming the measure could yield about $500 billion over the next decade. We've seen this movie before. Early in his term, President Obama proposed removing all tax breaks for oil and gas exploration companies, and in 2017 he pushed for a $10 per barrel tax on the oil production, banned new coal leasing on federal lands, and he imposed a virtual moratorium on offshore drilling. Even the former squatter, Trump, considered hiking taxes on oil and gas to help pay for his big tax cut. The Biden plan has three specific targets: deductions for intangible drilling costs, the percentage depletion, and the foreign tax credit. Some in the administration want to limit similar deductions for hard rock and mining companies by reducing or eliminating tax preferences for oil, natural gas, and minerals. Would be a fucking serious mistake. This is especially the case for the hard rock minerals that have given the imports of minerals and metals critical for transitioning to clean energy technologies have doubled over the past 20 years. Since going back to 1913, oil and gas companies have been able to expense to ex have been able to expense the intangible drilling costs, which are more like the research and development deductions enjoyed by other industries, and they are defined as costs necessary for the preparation of wells for production, but that have no salvageable value. These include expenses for wages, fuel supplies, repairs, survey work, and ground clearing and compromise, roughly to 60 to 80% of the total drilling costs. Eliminating this deduction would discourage the production and innovation in the energy sector, thereby jeopardizing valuable technical advances such as reducing the methane emissions from oil and gas wells. The percentage depletion of allowance provides an effective way to account for the depreciation of the underlying value of the mineral reserves and has been around for more than a century. The deduction applies not only to some oil and gas producers, but also to coal, many metals and sand and gravel producers. Without the percentage depletion, many stripper wells, that's kind of an odd term, those producing fewer than 15 barrels a day, and accounting for 20% of the domestic production, would be abandoned and shut in, moving to an alternative such as cost depletion. And that would mean higher expenses and confusion for royalty owners and small companies in particular. Finally, the administration wants to eliminate the credit for foreign taxes that are levied on oil and gas production. Not only would such a move be discriminatory, it would weaken the competitive position of the large American energy companies in the global marketplace. It's unfortunate and misleading that politicians refer to these tax deductions as subsidies. But in fact, the oil, gas, and coal industries don't receive subsidies, but rather like every other fucking industry, they're allowed to take tax fucking deductions for the expenses that they incur. And these deductions aren't the product of fucking special favors. They're the kind of standard relief afforded manufacturers, mining companies, and other businesses to help defray the basic cost of operations. For example, oil and gas companies can deduct their expenses for things such as equipment purchases and rig technician salaries. The point of these deductions, as for any other industry or individual, is to ensure that taxes are levied only on income and after the expenses. In practice, the tax preferences available to the oil and gas industry are quite modest, amounting to about $3 billion annually. What's more, before the pandemic, the industry was paying taxes at a higher effective rate than most others, and it was contributing more than $87 million daily to the federal treasury. The industry was also paying billions of dollars annually in state and local sales, property income taxes, and royalties, and during the worst of the pandemic, oil and gas companies, large and small, incurred huge losses, laid off thousands of workers, and substantially they reduced the investment spending. Though profits are slowly returning as the domestic and global economies regain strength, the balance sheets of many companies remain weak. Hiking taxes on an industry in the recovery mode makes little economic sense. Let's not forget that America is now the world's number one oil and natural gas producing country, with all the economic and energy security benefits that follow. We become a net energy exporter, placing additional tax burdens on America's energy industry, already one of the most heavily regulated and taxed industrial sectors. And it will not only imperil our hard-won energy independence, but it also could result in the higher energy costs for businesses and households. So that's that on that one. There's been a lot of news. There's been a lot of shit going on in the town where I live at. I live in a shitty area called Maryville, Indiana. And there has been a lot of shit going around, like with cops and everything. The other day, we have two McDonald's that are not too far from us and a Taco Bell. And so there's really not a whole lot of restaurants in the town where I'm living at. Like, we got a couple McDonald's, a couple a Long John Silver's, a Wendy's, and Arby's. And the other day they were blocking off McDonald's over at 61st, which is the street that it sits on. And then I don't know what the hell was going on. And then the other day, but was it yesterday? I was heading up to work, and they had the Taco Bell blocked off. I'm like, well, what the fuck is up with all these fucking cops? So I don't know what the hell was going on yesterday. So I don't know what the fuck the reason it was for all the cops being out there, or what the fuck they were doing exactly, but who knows. And then somebody was bitching the other day about this Wendy's that used to be where I used to work at Meijer. And they had closed down that Wendy's because they only had, like, one manager. And so, obviously, they wanted the manager to, work from open to close. And basically, the manager said fuck that. So right now, they don't have a manager. So now that particular Wendy's is closed until they get another manager. Can't really say much, because even at my job, Longhorn, they don't have a lot of managers. They only got, like, three of them. Shit. And just to show you that a lot of people in my area need help, I was walking through one of the grocery stores in my area called Strachan Mantill. Now, it used to be called Ultra Foods, but Ultra Foods closed down about a couple years ago. So all the Ultra Foods were brought out by Strachan Mantill. I was in this Strachan Mantill earlier today shopping. They're looking for, like, workers, and so I'm reading the sign about what they offer them benefits. And they offer everything that Longhorn offers except for one thing. Because Longhorn doesn't offer, they don't really offer vacation time. Or actually, Longhorn does, but they don't pay you for it. Now, Strachan Mantill, it's still a grocery store, but it's way smaller than what Meijer was. And so, this particular grocery store, it basically, when I was reading their sign for the benefits that they offered, you got, basically, they had part-time and full-time, which I would always do full-time, because the more hours you work, the more money you get. Then they got the holiday pay, the paid vacation, but you have to work there a year before you can get paid vacation. And then they also offered, there was a couple other things they offered. There was the holiday pay, the 401k, the paid vacation after you've been there a year, and then you had full and part-time positions. I would always do full-time because that's how I like it. Because I was fucking hungry because I didn't eat anything earlier today. Me and my mother went out to Panda Express. Which is like a knockoff of Chinese food, but I still love Panda Express. And I got my usual orange chicken with rice and a veggie roll. And so that's what's for my dinner tonight. Very slowly, I've been reading some of my books, too. I'm currently reading the book, Classic Horror Tales, but it's like all these short stories in one. And the current chapter I'm on is The Pit and the Pendulum, which I think was, which is an Edgar Allan Poe story. My only bitch complaint, though, is because those books are so fucking old. Like those storylines. It's very poor English because it's old English back from the 17 and 1800s. So it's kind of hard to understand what they're talking about in the book. Man, I'm just tired too. Let's see what we got here. Oh, crap, hold on. Biden is right that it's time for us to leave Afghanistan. We should have done that years ago. Joe Biden did not give the speech his critics wanted to hear when he addressed the nation on the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, but he gave the speech that every American needed to hear, even if the inbreds didn't want to hear it. Biden keenly aware of the impact of the horrifying scenes of chaos in the Afghan capital of Kabul, looked straight into the camera and said, "I am the President of the United States, and the buck stops with me." He acknowledged the mayhem and the human toll it's taken on, and he expressed his clear anger at the failure of the Afghan government and military to mount a defense of their own country. He specifically noted that the government had urged the U.S. not to begin early evacuations of foreign nationals because of the message it might send. After he spoke, the talking heads came out in force and argued that he did not accept responsibility, but the buck stops here, as the ultimate expression of the president owning his actions. Not true, but, you know, they said that he did not explain how we could be in the situation we are in, but what they really mean is that he did not give the explanation that they wanted. CNN's Jake Tapper called Biden's description of the swift collapse of the Afghan central government and military finger-pointing, but it was indeed that collapse that accounted for the speed of the Taliban's takeover. When the Afghan forces that the U.S. Has invested billions in should have stood up, they did not. Given that it was widely expected that the Taliban would have ultimately seize control of the country, and they were, after all, the parties with whom the last administration was negotiating, the key variable was whether the Taliban would meet any resistance at all. Biden described the measures being taken to get thousands of embassy employers, or employees, U.S. citizens, citizens of the allied nations, and Afghans who had aiding allied forces out. He reasserted the commitment of the U.S. to using international mechanisms to provide aid to the people of Afghanistan and stressed that the U.S. would continue to place human rights at the center of our foreign policy priorities. It would have been heartening to hear him use the tougher language with regard to applying the international pressure should the rights of the women and girls be violated. He should have made a commitment to investigate fully where things went wrong with the exit plan, but he left no uncertainty about our willingness to use force in the event that violent extremists posing a threat to the U.S. again within Afghanistan's borders. I'm deeply saddened by the facts that we now face, but I do not regret my decision to end America's war fighting in Afghanistan. I cannot and will not ask our troops to fight endlessly in another country's civil war, Biden said. He noted that the collapse that we are seeing might have occurred a few years ago or a few years hence, but the way it unfolded provided further evidence that extending the stay of the U.S. military in Afghanistan would have been unlikely to produce a different outcome anyway. Biden's reiteration of the rationale behind his decision underscored that we do not have any urgent national interest for which to fight in Afghanistan right now, and that we have manifold urgent priorities elsewhere, and that was the main point that needed to be delivered to the nation. And finally, a U.S. president was willing to accept the consequences of doing the right thing. He was doing it because it would save the lives of members of the U.S. military, and he was doing it because the time was long overdue to take such a fucking step. There may be no American political leader who understands the issues in Afghanistan better than Biden. He was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when the U.S. first sent troops into Afghanistan in the fall of 2001, and he was chairman again after the 2006 elections through the beginning of the Obama administration, when it became clear that we had drifted from the clear mission of defeating Al-Qaeda and to an amorphous and therefore unachievable goal of somehow overhauling Afghanistan's government and internal security environment to our specifications. When Biden became vice president, he emerged as the leading voice for getting out of Afghanistan and recognizing that we had an unachievable mission there. He has watched as Obama ignored his advice and finally hesitated to exit the fight in the last years of his administration, but in the midst of the 2020 campaign, he watched as the squad of Donald Trump negotiated with the Taliban. Biden and those around him and honest observers know that the scenes of the Taliban regaining control of Afghanistan were completely predictable. He knows, in fact, that in large part that they are the consequence not of anything that he has done, but of the misguided decisions of the last three American presidents with regard to this fucking war. Those closest to Biden were gutted, as were all observers, to see the images of crowds clinging to transport planes and bodies falling to their deaths as those planes took off. They know that the sheer ugliness of this departure and the undoubted miscalculation that led to that ugliness will live with them for the rest of their lives. But they also know that the far greater cost that would have come from once again deferring the decision to leave and adding to the costs that we have incurred over the past two decades. And this is why the president and the secretary of That is why the president stood up, acknowledged the situation, described what is being done to fulfill our obligations on the ground in Afghanistan, and then he said, in effect, "This is difficult, horrible, even, but we will not lose, our resolve to do what is fucking right." That is why Tapper had sniffed that the president and secretary of state, Antony Blinken, were dodging the question when they returned their focus to America's long-term interests. But it isn't about time a U.S. administration put our long-term interests first rather than worrying about the political fallout that they might face, because what they are doing is hard and difficult to control, and at times gut-wrenching and profoundly regrettable. The foreign policy specialists enjoy playing up the strategic aspects of what they do, often comparing it to a chess game, but for at least the past decade, the situation in Afghanistan has been more like Jenga. Slowly, cautiously, players have removed blocks from the stack, hoping that they would not be the one to do the inevitable and bring everything clattering down. Besides, his aides and his critics all knew that this is the way that the game would end. And the president today accepted responsibility for the outcome, and he let the American people have it straight about why he did what he did. Mistakes have been made in the fucking in this fucking last chapter of the U.S. experience in Afghanistan. But what is most important is that the president, after 2 long decades that have been suffering, that makes even that which we have seen this week fail in comparison, and has finally had the wisdom to say this will at least be our last final fucking chapter. Like I said, Biden is right in pulling us out of Afghanistan. That fucking shit was long overdue. I've been reading up on a lot of sports, though, too, and the Bulls are making a lot of roster moves in the hopes of competing. The Bulls have picked up DeMar DeRozan, Lonzo Ball. They just signed Alex Caruso to a 4-year deal. He's okay, but nothing great. And then you have, there was somebody else that they signed, too. Oh, backup center Tony Bradley. And then there's talks about maybe 3 people they should go after, if they do it. The three people that people are talking about going after, if you're going to go after after any player, there's 3 free agents that the Bulls should look after. DeMarcus Cousins is one of them, and then there was Wesley Matthews and one other. I will agree on DeMarcus Cousins. He might not be the player that he used to be, but he could still give you minutes when you need to, and he could still score points when he needs to, even in a short burst. So DeMarcus Cousins, actually, when he was playing for Sacramento Kings back years ago, he couldn't shoot a three pointer to save his fucking life, and now he's shooting threes with more consistency, and not just that, he can occasionally give you 20 points if not more when he's healthy. But that's about that on that part. So the Bulls are doing everything they can to try to compete. Let's see if it works out for them. Yeah, but Trump is blasting Biden's speech as incompetent. Yeah, that's funny coming from a guy who was incompetent his whole fucking 4 years of squatting in the Wales. I don't know about that, but Nicole Wallace just said that 95% of Americans will agree with Biden on his pull from Afghanistan. That might be it for all today, but I will be back in the next week or so to decide what to talk about. Maybe I'll talk about the movies I'm watching and any other shows on Netflix. And I'm going to finish my dinner before it gets really fucking cold to the point where I won't be able to eat it. But I hope you guys enjoyed, and this is episode 70.